Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
Hey, this is Ryan with the Songs of Note podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. If you are listening to the show and you're new, welcome. Be sure and subscribe so don't miss future episodes. We talk about songs and books and just all things music, all things related back to music, which, you know, is why you're here and why I'm here. And so I appreciate you being willing to give a listen to things that that I'm exploring, and what I, something I love doing is going down deep rabbit holes on the stories behind people's lives and albums and songs. And so it was a lot of fun getting to go back down. This is a rabbit hole I've been down a bunch of times, but Jimi Hendrix. And so he is somebody, for me, I was introduced to him. I didn't meet him. I was introduced to his music when I was in junior high and, you know, first starting to play guitar. And then you're looking at the notes on the page going, wait, what did he do? And then you try, then you figure out the notes of what he did. And then you're trying to make it happen back. And it's like those may be the notes, but it sure doesn't sound like that. So as a guitar player, there's not anybody that ranks above him in my book. And we'll talk about this here in a minute, but Jimmy is just such a complex figure. And so for me, the really fun part about doing the podcast is being able to say, okay, I'm gonna go down a rabbit trail, and man, it'd sure be cool to couple that with an interview on somebody who really knows a lot about Jimmy. And Charles R. Cross, who has come on the show before to talk about the biography of Kurt Cobain, several months back, one of my favorite episodes we've done, he was kind enough to come back on the show and talk about his book about Jimi Hendrix, and it's called Room Full of Mirrors. I'm going to put the link to buy the book in the show notes on Amazon. I have a hard copy and an audible copy so I can listen to it. And so he's just a super knowledgeable guy, and I love his take on music, and especially being from the Seattle area and having a knowledge of the background of that city, and then all the way through the 90s and on, he's just an expert on it. And so I loved hearing him bring Jimi Hendrix to life in the book, and then also hear him describe all the things that made Jimmy unique in this interview. So we're going to head on over to the interview. This is Charles R. Cross. Well, hey, I've got Charles R. Cross here. Charles, I am really excited to talk to you again. I appreciate you coming on a couple months back to talk about Kurt Cobain and the book that you had written on him, and now to come and talk about your Jimi Hendrix biography, Room Full of Mirrors. Thank you so much for coming on.
You're welcome. I love to talk about Jimmy any day, any time.
Well, I loved that was your response when I had reached out about Jimmy, and that was what you said. I love talking about him. Why do you love talking about Jimmy?
Well, you know, to me, Jimi Hendrix is just still simply the greatest musician of our era. There's so much about him that still remains a mystery and a paradox to even to me, someone who spent almost 4 years writing a biography of him. He's a mystery in that what he was able to accomplish in those 27 short years has just been so impactful. And even despite the fact that Jimi Hendrix is a huge star, obviously a legendary rock and roller, I still think he, in many ways, is underappreciated.
Yeah,
that's why I like talking about it.
Oh man, I love that. So the perspective that I'm coming from is I'm a guitar player. I played in a band for a long time as a lead guitar player, so I spent a lot of time on the guitar, and I cannot touch the stuff that he came up with. Like I can try it, and you hear people try to play Little Wing and Purple Haze, and it's just not the same. In my mind, he's not only the most innovative guitar player ever, but he's also just the best skillfully and imaginatively, I guess would be another way to put it. But is that what you take from him, from his playing? Like why does he rank so high for you personally?
Well, actually, it's almost the opposite. If you can take a little joshing, it's
yeah.
Like yourselves, I think, who have you know, wrongfully at times focused so much of Jimmy's legacy just on simply what an incredible gunslinger he was.
Mm-hmm.
And everything you're saying is true. Absolutely.
Yeah.
guy had just unbelievable technique. No one can quite reproduce it. Absolutely, the way he was able to simply hit notes and the notes he was able to hit in what order. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who spent their entire lives, a number of musicians, just simply trying to play exactly like Jimmy did. No one tries to play better than Jimmy did. People try to play as he did. But to me, I think that I want to call him a virtuoso of technique. I think at times that limits Jimmy. And I think that's unfortunately some of what people who weren't guitar players who thought of him or still think of him think, well, that's the guy with the amazing guitar runs and the wild solos and guitars on fire. There's the other side of Jimmy, which ultimately I think is to me more impressive. And that's the way he composed music, the melodies he came up with. When I want to play somebody some Jimi Hendrix to impress them or bring them into, you know, fandom of him, I never pick any of the outrageous electric ramps because I've heard those. Maybe they haven't heard them as well as Jimmy plays them, but they've heard other people do that. You know, Stevie Ray Vaughan is not a bad guitarist. The difference between Jimmy and Stevie is millimeters. There's still a difference, but Hendrix's acoustic material, particularly, and some of his authentic blues deep cuts, those are the songs that I go to because they also have an emotionalism that isn't always apparent in the wild guitar solos.
Well, man, I totally agree. And I love that you brought up Stevie because, you know, I've had extensive discussions about Stevie versus Jimmy because I love Stevie's playing. And I think technically he's such a good player, but I think Jimmy propelled music as a whole by not only his playing, like you said, but like by the sounds, the style, the writing. So for me, he is light years above Stevie in that way. What are your, like, I love his more mournful songs. Actually, those are the ones that really like resonate with me, like Castles Made of Sand and Little Wing and May This Be Love. So many just beautiful slow songs. Are those the ones that you end up playing for people? Or I'm curious what the cuts are that you play.
You know, if someone asked me what's my single most played Hendrix album, you know, I argue that Electric Ladyland is his best creative studio output. Band of Gypsies, it's hard to argue with that as one of the greatest live albums by anybody of all time.
Agreed.
And yet, the thing that I play the most is an obscure release that Jimmy's estate is a complete and utter mess and has been even before he died. But the early version of his estate did authorize a release of a CD called Jimi Hendrix Home Recordings. The CD came with a graphic novel of Jimi Hendrix's life, and it only has, I think, six or seven songs on it, most of which have been released in some form or another. But essentially, it's a recording of Jimmy in a hotel room or in a studio. And to me, the intimacy of hearing him without any studio effects, really strikes home to me. And that track, that recording that I'm talking about, happens to include, you know, what I think is one of Jimmy's greatest songs, emotionally, melodically, and that's the song "Angel." He wrote almost certainly about his mother.
Mm-hmm.
So that track, if anybody wants to search for it, that I'm talking about, it comes in a graphic novel called Voodoo Child, and the CD itself is called By Himself, The Home Recordings. And as I said, it was officially released. The estates afterwards never allowed it to be put out again, but when you say in a state officially released a track, it can't be qualified as a bootleg. It was authorized and put out. And again, it's only got 6 tracks. It's Cherokee Jam, Hear My Train A-Comin', Voodoo Child, Gypsy Eyes, Angel, Merman I Should Turn to Be. But because of the intimacy of the quality of the recording, that's what really draws me in emotionally in Jimmy's work. Not like I couldn't name, if you talk to me tomorrow, I will name 20 other songs that
right.
are Hendrix song. That's the way it was.
Yeah, no, that's great. I love that. And I was actually listening to the demo version of Voodoo Child from that recording this past week, which it just sounds like he's writing the song with you in the room. And it's just incredible. So I love that. For people who like, I love being able to ask some questions to let people know a little bit more about Jimmy's story, and so that they can find out the whole story in your book. So I'd love to ask you some questions about some things you talk about in the book. You open the book talking about Jimmy's mother's gravesite and a crazy story about how you were involved with finding that and helping bring dignity to her gravesite. Yeah. Would you mind telling that story a little bit, how that happened?
Yeah. I mean, again, it sounds like I'm making this up. It doesn't even sound like it could have happened to me, even story. But, when I started researching Jimmy's life, I knew where his gravesite was. I had visited that. And it's not in Seattle. It's in a town outside Seattle. So it's in the suburbs. Not a place that Jimmy ever spent any time, but it was a graveyard that was cheaper, so to speak. Mm. So his father also had been buried there, and the latest incarnation of the estate built a fancy tomb for his father. And but his mother, when I searched for her, actually at the point I found his mother's grave, I think his dad may have still been alive. But nonetheless, his mother's grave, I just couldn't find. And I kept asking family members, where is she buried? And they said, well, she's buried at the same cemetery Jimmy is. And I'm like, why did no one ever mention this ever before? And I went out there 3-4 times to the cemetery and kept asking, where's her grave? Mm. I could never get a clear answer. And I became a pest. And finally went out there and said, I'm going to stay here basically until you guys find your grave. Hmm. Literally a guy from the graveyard grabbed a shovel.
Oh gosh.
This one area. And he said, well, here are where the welfare graves are. Hmm. He buried all close together and it's all grown over. And he started digging holes.
Oh,
and
man.
I didn't know at that point. My expertise is, left-handed guitar players out of Seattle's album, Graveyards. I didn't know if the guy was digging down till he was going to hit bones or a
cast. Oh my gosh.
He dug a few holes, and then finally on one of them, he pulled a brick out. It literally looked just like a brick you'd see on the side of your house, and the brick had etched into it the word Mitchell, which was mother's name of her last marriage when she died. And that's basically if you were black or just plain poor, but particularly if you were black and poor and you had no money for a funeral, that's what you got in the era that Lucille Jeter Hendrix Mitchell died, a loose brick just laying there, which anyone could have stolen from the graveyard before it got grown over. The most amazing part of that story, and I won't keep going on and on about it, was that I had been out there with a number of family members, and I said, where do you think she's buried? And they would kind of point to this one area of the cemetery. And basically, they had been praying for decades in the wrong part of the cemetery.
Oh, wow. The
truth was that Lucille was not that far from where Jimmy was buried. And that is just complete and total happenstance, because it wasn't like anybody had remembered where Lucille was buried at the point Jimmy died, which is, I think there's 11 years between their burials. But, this woman did not have a proper gravestone. So the contrast here of Jimi Hendrix then, who the current estate had moved to a multi-million dollar Italian marble mausoleum, and his mother, who had a welfare brick, was really disheartening. So I was involved in an effort. I was one of a number of people to raise some funds to get her a proper headstone. And that was done, and it was rededicated in a ceremony a couple years after my book came out.
Gosh, I would think, as someone as invested as you into his story, and in, I would assume, getting to know the family, that must be satisfying to have a part in bringing that dignity about. I mean, I just I read the opening part. I was like, what? What are we doing? What happened? Oh my gosh!
Satisfying, but I have to say, there always are struggles as a biographer when you get in these stories. You go like, what can I do? You know. And your job as a biographer is not to fix the family or fix the life or fix the history. Hmm. Job is to tell the story. Your main relationship is with the reader. But you're a human being, so you can't but help but be offended when you hear things that have happened. I mean, right. I we could talk for hours about the mess of Jimmy's estate, but let me just state one sentence for anyone who listens to this to understand it. Since Jimi Hendrix died in 1970, not one dime, not one nickel, dime, penny from the sales of his recordings have ever benefited or profited the matriarchal line of Jimmy's family.
Wow.
His aunt who raised him, his various other relatives on his mother's side, none of them have had any profit from Jimmy's, from any Jimmy recording. You buy a Jimi Hendrix album now, the money does not go to his mother's family, all of whom live in abject poverty. It also, Jimmy had 6 to 7, depending on what story, brothers and sisters. And, you know, one of those got a tiny bit of dough when Jimmy's dad was alive, but the other 6 have never also profited at all from that. And I'll just put a period on that and say yep. that sad part of the story. And you know, again, I'm a biographer. I can't change those facts, but I think it is important for people to know. And also, when you buy Jimi Hendrix's albums, you are not benefiting an estate that is run by Black people. That's unbelievable. But for the most part, that has not been that. That's the way that it has been for a number of years. You know, we do have some people in Seattle that are up and ending on that. That has become an issue in the last year in Seattle. There have been not exactly protests about Jimi Hendrix, but there's been an increased visibility about Seattle's most famous Black musician. What does he really have to do with Black culture in Seattle? And that's been getting debated a bit now.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, thank you for expounding on that. And yeah, we'll leave a pin in that. I do want to ask you some questions about Jimmy's life. And so the story you told the story that, and I was listening to this on Audible, and I have the hard copy too, because I read it a couple of years back, but I wanted to listen to it again before we talked, and I was started cracking up out loud. For people who don't know, Jimmy played with Little Richard, right? So he was the guitar player with Little Richard. And you told the story how Little Richard did not like to be upstaged, and he even fined people who wore things that were outside of their assigned uniform. And can you talk about like where Jimmy was at as far as being someone who was in his band, and what level of frustration Jimmy must have reached on the night where you describe him wearing a hat, a woman's blouse, and doing all of Little Richard's moves to basically, it seemed like he was just trying to get fired. But I thought that story was so great.
Yeah, well, that happened with Jimmy in a number of bands where his flashiness got, you know, the ire of the band leader. You know, traditional R&B bands, you know, are supposed to be a certain way. They're supposed to have a horn section. The guitar player is primarily a rhythm instrument. It is not usually the lead instrument. In most R&B bands, the piano drives the band, or the drums. Jimmy didn't think that way. And so, yeah, he not only did he play in Little Richard's band, what's the most amazing part of the story is when Little Richard died I did some further research on it. I do mention this in my book, but I had to go back and at the point Little Richard died, and I wanted to make sure what I wrote was correct. But when Jimmy was 16, he went and met Little Richard.
Yeah.
In this church in the Central District, and then, you know, 8 years later, he's in Little Richard's band. Maybe less than that, six years later, and then, you know, eventually he's taking and basically stealing some of Little Richard's act, and then moving it to white rock audiences in England. It wasn't just Little Richard's act. I mean, I think one thing about the world of R&B there is that everybody borrowed from many of them. You know, Jimmy took parts of Lightnin' Hopkins and parts of B.B. King's act, and certainly parts of Albert King's act, and he melded them. And that tradition of kind of interpreting music and moving it on is certainly accepted and for many artists. So it's not exactly fair to say that he stole it, but Little Richard felt he did.
Yeah.
Little Richard, you know, Jimmy was not in Little Richard's band for very long. He was in a number of bands. He was in the Isley Brothers. He was that, you know, probably had a huge effect on him musically, maybe even more than Little Richard. When I listened to Electric Ladyland, that record seems so impacted by the kind of melodic rhythm guitar of the Isley Brothers. You know, there's a lot of that sound that I think is on Electric Ladyland.
Yeah, I can hear that. Well, so going on stage kind of moves, I'm curious what you think. Like, I wonder, based on like how you describe it, you know, a lot of people, when they think Jimi Hendrix, they can picture him lighting a guitar on fire. You picture him playing between his legs, or he's doing crazy stage moves. By the end of his life, he wasn't doing that. And at least as far as I know, not as much as he was. Do you think he felt that he had to do those things to get the attention, to get people listen? And then do you think he felt bound to keep doing it?
Your audio is breaking up a little bit for me.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. You were. I got your sentence, but your sound quality was breaking up a bit. I think the answer to that question is yes and no. Even in the early days, I mean, Monterey, which is filmed, and, you know, Jimmy lighting the guitar on fire and smashing it is, you know, a huge story in the history of rock. But that's about 3 minutes and 40 seconds of that show. You know, the other 40 minutes of that show are pretty straight ahead, Jimmy just playing. But those are not included in the Monterey film. So I think that's part of the we remember these moments. We remember Jimi Hendrix singing the Star Spangled Banner, or playing it, not singing it, at Woodstock. And, you know, again, that was part of a 90-minute set, which at times was rambling and not focused. Jimmy started off with more of those stage tricks. I do feel he felt trapped by them because people expected to see the dog and pony show.
Yeah.
And he felt like he kind of had to do it. But, you know, he didn't burn that many guitars. He didn't break that many guitars. I mean, a few dozen. I mean, some super fans have tracked it online. So I could be wrong in my numbers, just stating it off the top of my head without my research in front of me, but it's not like he did it every night. It wasn't something that was always happening, but it is what we remember about him. If you look at the Band of Gypsies show, for example, the legendary Fillmore East live shows, those concerts, there's no tricks whatsoever. It's in a trio with, essentially the only all African American band that he was in under his own. And he's exploring a very different style in that recording, which, I think was more the direction that he wanted to go. it's always hard to speculate about where was Jimi Hendrix going to go? What was he going to be up to? You know, if he would have lived, we don't know that, of course, but in all likelihood, he would have explored more music that was traditionally R&B or jazz. Those were the things that he said. The paradigm, the handcuffs of what was expected for a rock act to do, those were limiting for Jimmy, as they were for everybody in that era.
Well, I love the story about how he met with Miles Davis, and he even sent a telegram to Paul McCartney talking about how they're going to form this band. I mean, that's where I envision. And I think you even talked about him like doing a band with horns, since he had that kind of background. Yeah. It is interesting to think, man, what would this have turned into had he had time? I mean, really, the years of output are so limited for the amount of incredible work that's still there.
Yeah. Lived 27 years. There's really only 4 years of him being a star. He only did music even for 10 years. I mean, really, and that seems crazy.
Yeah.
And then the other part, you were asking me sort of, you know, to some degree, what was most surprising to me. And I think I found myself surprised when I began to do research and found that Jimmy wasn't that good early on. He showed moments of brilliance, but people that grew up with Jimmy in Seattle, to a man and woman, not a single one of them said that Jimmy was the best guitarist in the neighborhood. And that it took a while for him to find his voice. And I think he did that really more around probably the time he was 19. He started to really grab. He was good before that, but I think he started to find where he could make the guitar emotionally talk. Mm. Prior to that, he was mimicking and learning technique for the most part.
Hmm. Well, I love the story about you talked about how Hendrix was brought over to England, and really the plan was to break him big there and then bring him back to America. And I think it was on that first trip when he went to the Cream show and basically asked if he could play with Cream, which nobody ever did because they were like the top guys out there. Can you tell a little bit about that story?
Yeah, well, that also shows, you know, Jimmy was a shy guy in some ways, but he got famous because he put himself out there. You know, he definitely tried, you know. And the there's almost no other word than chutzpah. I want to use a more a vulgar word, but Jimmy had chutzpah, put it that way. Yeah. Be able to get up there and ask to jam with these guys. And Clapton was shocked that anybody would ask, you know. I don't think it's completely fair to say that he wiped the stage, but he made an impression. And sometimes within comparing guitar players, there gets to be whose solos are flashier. It's not a empirical measurement but it is absolutely true that Jimmy, that helped make him a star. And people were talking about that. You know, it was pre-internet. It was the kind of era where somebody would say, "Hey, did you see this guy at the Cream show? Did you hear about that?" You know.
Yeah.
And you know, I did interview a number of musicians. I mean, since my book has come out, I've had many further conversations with other musicians that were, you know, they count Graham Nash and Pete Townsend and these other people, they cite themselves seeing Hendrix is the most important moment in their musical lives.
Wow. That's incredible.
That says a lot. I don't know. Maybe Townsend wouldn't go that far, but he would, he, you know, there's a story Townsend told me about, he's with Clapton and they're watching Hendrix and they end up holding hands. The writer's metaphor on that and describe it as if like two squirrel girls watching their crush, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I think sometimes that story can get, those stories can get overblown, because it wasn't like that Eric Clapton or Pete Townsend put the guitar down and never picked it up after seeing Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
But there was a lot of rivalry in that world, you know.
Well, that's interesting. And I love that. I love that, like, the shock factor that you can just pick up from the words in the book of, like, what this guy must have made those top dogs feel like. Like, I'm sure they were threatened. But I like the, I also like the story about the Beatles that you talked about, where you said one of the boldest moves Hendrix ever made was playing Sgt. Pepper in front of the Beatles at Brian Epstein's club 3 days after the record came out. Would you tell a little bit about that story and kind of, like, for people who don't, who aren't in thinking in that world? I mean, that's so bold. It's so incredible to consider playing something that just came out that, you know, you're probably lucky to even get a copy of it, much less learn it. And he taught the band the song backstage, right? I mean, wasn't it right beforehand?
It was. And yeah. If I don't have the dates in front of me, so if I get it wrong, but I'm pretty sure that Sgt. Pepper came out like on a Friday and this show was on a Sunday. It was within 3 days of Sgt. Pepper coming out, being officially released. And Jimmy created the set list of what they played, you know, before a show, but they were generally pretty standard. But, you know, about an hour before the show is going to start, Noel Redding told me the story of Jimmy is backstage and there's a record player, because there used to be record players everywhere. So that was the only way you could really hear music. And Jimmy says, we're going to start with this, and put Sgt. Pepper's title song on. And Noel describes looking, is, you know, the eye look that he and Mitch made to each other and back to Jimmy of just being incredulous. But of course, no one was going to say, we heard that. I mean, Noel had bluffed his way into the first one by saying he played guitar, and he didn't. I mean, playing bass, and he was a guitar player. You know, he had the, if I'm remembering correctly, the first time he ever picked a bass up was when he was auditioning for The Experience. So that's pretty extraordinary.
That's crazy.
But in any case, and Jimmy was working the song out. And, you know, the most amazing thing about that version of Sgt. Pepper is that Jimmy essentially plays the horn section on his guitar. It's not like this was available in sheet music at the local store. And Jimmy couldn't write music, so he's you know, obviously learning and playing by ear, but it's a pretty awesome version of Sgt. Pepper. If it would have gone bad, this is pre-Monterey. Jimmy was not yet a superstar or even really a star. He's playing, I think, an 1800 seat theater. I mean, the other thing that there's so many parts of the story that, again, it just sounds like you're making it up. The show that Jimmy plays Sgt. Pepper at, Procol Harum, debut Whiter Shade of Pale, that show earlier.
Wow.
You know, you go, like, what were you getting on a given Sunday night at the Savile Theater in England? You know, you get Procol Harum's the opening act. They play Whiter Shade of Pale for the very first time.
Wow.
Jimi Hendrix comes on stage with at least two Beatles. It's always been a little confusing what Beatles were in the audience, but there are at least two Beatles there, and he starts the show. I mean, it's one thing to encore.
Right.
Now, there's a great new little album out this week that you might have heard about. I'm going to do a, you know, weird version of it. He doesn't say any of that. He just starts the show with Sgt. Pepper. That's the part that just go, I can't imagine that. I'm shy any aspect of my life. The ability for someone to do that is just beyond me even. I can't imagine that.
Yeah, that's crazy. Well, I mean, I can only speak from my limited experience of I spent time in a band. And it took a lot to learn a song and for the band to feel comfortable playing a song. Like, it would take a bunch of times playing it. So I can't imagine them hearing the song, probably for one of the first times, learning it, and then saying, hey, we're playing in front of the Beatles, and let's open with their song. That I love that you said that's one of the most boldest moves he did.
As I started to say, it could have backfired. If it had really been bad, there was the point, there were many bands in England, and there still are today, that start off with lots of glitz. And if Hendrix hadn't had songs like The Wind Cries Mary and some of the other songs that weren't like massive hits but showed his musicality, he might not have had a career. He might have had a one or two singles career. I mean, the numbers of the streets of London are lined with people who had one or two hit singles but didn't put a great album out. But Hendrix, or there are even a number of acts that were big in England that never really made it to America. I can name dozens of pub bands of that era and later eras that were big in England but just couldn't quite cross over into the U.S. Well, that Savile Theater move got Paul McCartney's attention. It's part of the reason McCartney pushed for Hendrix at Monterey, and Monterey changes everything about Jimmy's life.
Man, he took a big risk and it paid off in a big way. Well, I don't want to take too much more of your time. I have one last question, and it's around, you named the book Room Full of Mirrors, which is a Hendrix song, and you kind of come back to that theme throughout the book. You talk about Jimmy's dad, had an actual mirror that had broken glass, or that Jimmy had made into a piece of art, I believe. He recorded the Room Full of Mirrors song several times, including a spoken word version of the song. What do you think the significance was for Jimmy on the song Room Full of Mirrors?
Yeah, I don't want to overstate the significance. I like the title, and I think metaphorically it shows one of the ideas that I wanted to present, which is that there was the public Hendrix, and then the real Hendrix was a reflection of many, many different pieces. And that image looked very different than the guy on stage with the electric guitar. But Jimmy thought it was a song that was very meaningful to him. He was a deep guy. He believed in astrology. He, read lots of science fiction books. He thought that there was a spiritual world, and, his death, how shocking it is that he died so young. But even he didn't think he would live that long. I think it was a crazy funhouse of a ride. It definitely saddens me. I don't want to be flippant that Jimmy died so young. If there were any musician that I wanted to see another decade worth of music from, it was Jimi Hendrix. I mean, I'm not young enough to have seen Hendrix. I bought Electric Ladyland when I was 16, but he was dead at that point. But he had a huge influence on me just as a person. The idea that he could take such complicated, layered, ethereal, spiritual woo-woo ideas and put them in a rock album, that greatly affected me and countless others. Thank you, Jimmy, for everything you did. And wherever you are up in the skies, in those castles made of sand, I'm so grateful to have the music.
Yeah, that's the truth. Well, to your point at the beginning, he's certainly someone who is shrouded in mystery and also intrigue. And for people listening, I'm going to put the link to the book in the show notes, but it is Room Full of Mirrors by Charles R. Cross. Charles, thank you so much for taking time to chat on the show today. It's great, great time getting to chat with you.
Always nice talking to you.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.